I want to ask you about the role of women. And I wrote an article years ago about the role of women in keeping and growing family wealth. And I really smiled and when I saw in your book how you bring up the topic of women, how throughout history, women held the majority of financial assets at times. Can you talk about the two topics, the fact that women played such a big role and this joint stock market world open up the world to women and more people in general, not just the, let's say, the cliquey elite group that had the capital initially.
This is actually fascinating, and this is one of the features of the role played by finance in history, which is often forgotten. Women were not recognized juridically the same ability to act in the economy as men. So, this is born out of gender-based discrimination, of course. Compared to other sectors of the economy, the women were much freer to act in finance than, in trade, right? We can observe how they act. They were perfectly able to operate in an accurate way and to get very good profits. And if I can, I will tell you a little story about a very striking woman.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest topic of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question, what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, and investment advisor to wealth creators with patient capital and an infinite investment horizon. I work with families and individuals who aspire to grow wealth over a lifetime and generations through disciplined, thoughtful investments in durable, quality businesses while giving money meaning. Join me on this quest to unearth and share the wisdom of the ages. I'll keep it short. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to my website, Bogumil Baranowski, where I read your emails and reply to all, and I even offer Zoom calls to you, my listeners. If you want to follow my essays, go to Substack. If you're curious about my last book, search for Crisis Investing. If you want to keep up with Talking Billions, subscribe, follow, and please share it around. It means the world to me. There's no marketing budget behind the podcast. There's no ad revenue. It's all word of mouth and genuine curiosity, yours, mine, and that of our guests. On to the show. Just a quick reminder, I'm the host of the show, but I also work for a registered investment advisor. This episode is for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. My views are personal and not those of the firm. Any securities mentioned are for illustrative purposes and are not recommendations. Investing involves risks. Please consult a financial advisor. Full disclosure can be found in the notes and at the end of the episode. My guest today is Guido Alfani. He is a professor of economic history at Bocconi University, Milan, Italy. He's also an affiliated scholar at the Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality in New York and a research fellow of the Center for Economic Policy Research in London. In the last 15 years, Guido has focused his research on economic inequality in the long run of history and on the history of major pandemics, often combining the two topics. His most recent book, published by Princeton University Press, is dedicated to the rich, the very rich and the super rich, and it is entitled as Gods Among Men, A History of the Rich in the West. Today, my guest takes us on a trip back in time. I love history. I strongly believe that it rhymes. And there are many patterns worth recognizing as they can help us understand the present and maybe look into the future. Professor Alfani tells us how wealth has evolved over time, with different societies defining it in various ways. He introduces us to three main paths to riches. You'll have to listen to find out what they are. He also discusses a topic close to my heart and my professional pursuits, inherited wealth throughout the ages. Guido explains how maintaining wealth over multiple generations proved to be a challenge throughout history. We take on a revolutionary role of finance, and specifically the stock market, in keeping and growing wealth among more people, including women. Speaking of women, Guido's book offers a greater understanding of the role they played in their families, preserving fortunes, especially in times of turmoil and change. Stay tuned until the end when my guest reveals the most consistent strategy for wealth accumulation throughout the centuries and leaves us with some advice on how to avoid losing wealth once we have it. It's all music to my ears. He's a very special guest with a unique book that ties together many of the topics and questions that I've studied, observed, and experienced over the last 20 years of my career as an investment advisor to affluent families and individuals. Please help me welcome Professor Guido Alfani. Hi, hello, how are you, Guido? So nice to see you.
I'm very fine and well met.
Well, I'm a big fan of your book, and I came across your book because of William Green, who wrote Richer, Wiser, Happier. He has a podcast with the same name, and he's a good friend. We got to see each other at this year's ValueX, Guy Spier's ValueX, and he mentioned your book, and I picked it up. I got intrigued for many reasons. As you know by now, I manage money for wealthy individuals, families, and I notice how stories rhyme throughout history, and I'm a big student of history. And in your book, you have this gift of certain ease of weaving stories and themes throughout history, and you get to introduce us to all kinds of characters throughout history that were very successful, accomplished, and wealthy, and how they had an impact on society. And it's just such a wonderful read, so I'm delighted to have you on the show. So thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's really a pleasure.
I want to jump right in, and I'll ask about the book in a second, but I want to hear more about the early days, your childhood upbringing. What was it like, and how do you think that time inspired you and led you to the career path that you're on today? Would you indulge me?
So I grew up in northwestern Italy, in a region which is called Piedmont, which is very beautiful, very, you know, still has like a nice environment. I come from a pretty scenic area close to the Alps. In some sense, I come from a provincial area, but one which also has strong cultural traditions and strong cultural institutions. So I never felt like, you know, cut off from the rest of the world or from the rest of Italy. My family when I was a kid was really a very normal family, and I think this kind of gave me some values. I am careful with money, if you want. I am surely much more of a saver than a spender, and this kind of remained with me. But when I was a teenager, my father became his own entrepreneur. Basically, he had his own activity, and our economic conditions started to improve also, so we could afford more. And and then I moved to the big city for the university. I went to study economics in Milan, in a program in economics and social sciences, actually, which I think was very engaging and very stimulating intellectually. And that's where I decided that I was actually interested in making research my own job. And that's also when I became interested in inequality as a research topic. And this was basically because I remember as a student, I was asking some of my, you know, my teachers, these economists, about inequality, because I thought they were like, you know, not discussing certain implications, what they were saying. And I tended to get very unsatisfying answers. So this kind of, you know, made me curious. And it's also one of the reasons why I started, you know, developing this interest in economic history, because the economic historians were much more interested in that topic than the economists did that in that moment and in that context. And then I was lucky enough to actually be able to pursue this career.
The topic itself is fascinating, and the history perspective is even more interesting because you get to see how the stories rhyme. And I want to ask you about the book, but before I ask you about the book, I want to ask you about the cover. And you and I briefly talked about it, and there's a story behind the cover, and you were very specific about the choice. Can you tell the story?
Right. Absolutely. Well, first of all, the cover is a painting by Rembrandt, dated 1636, and that's A Polish Nobleman. So, mm-hmm. I am often asked why I chose Discover, and the point is I was made four proposals by Princeton, my publisher, and I went for this one not because that's a nobish, no sorry that's a Polish nobleman, but because in the very center of the cover you have this big pearl, which then I studied, you know, where these kind of pearls came from. They were imported from the Indian Ocean, basically. They were collected there and then exported to Europe in that period. And the fact is, I had in the introduction and then also in the conclusion to the book, this metaphor as the rich, as the pearl in the oyster, like, you know, produced by the living body of the economy, but also somehow but the living body of society, but also somehow perceived as extraneous to it. And so I thought, well, you know, that's a nice opportunity of connecting to that. And I think it's a very nice painting. I love Rembrandt in general. And I noticed that a lot of people like the cover. So indeed, it was a good choice, you know?
Well, you had to choose somebody that represents the ages and the centuries and the millennia of wealth that you write about in the book. And I was born in Poland. So when I saw the painting, I thought, I know this painting. And the character looks familiar. A Polish nobleman, probably from 16, 1700s. And yeah, it resonated with me, not just the title and the story, but the cover itself. The title is As Gods Among Men, A History of the Rich in the West. And I've read many books about the rich throughout history, and I find them fascinating, both biographies and the studies like yours. But yours is different. You kind of took a different angle. Can you talk about that? You bring it up in the book, how it's a different story of the rich throughout history. Tell us why.
Yes, because in the end, the something which I realized by chance when I was writing, you know, an article which was more about the estimates of the top wealth shares across history and these things. And for that article, I was looking for some context information to make it less dry. And that's when I realized that there was basically no proper scientific studies of the rich as a category defined only by wealth. There are a lot of books about individual, you know, about rich mm-hmm. individuals or right. wealthy dynasties. But basically no proper social science attempt at focusing on who the rich were, you know, especially across time, because I also wanted to take a very long time perspective, and also no systematic attempt at studying the rich and all the different angles which I think are relevant to our understanding of their role in society also, right? So how they became wealthy, but also the social role they played and how they were perceived by society. And again, I stumbled, I come to this topic from my general interest in inequality, but it was really a surprise to realize that there was no such attempt, before this one. And So, yes, I think it's a bit of a different angle compared to what others have done.
I think so too, a fresh perspective. So I have to ask you, wealth, money, being rich, it means different things. And can you talk about that over the ages, how the concept, the definition has evolved, and even the components of what we consider wealth has changed? You talk about it all around the book, which I found interesting. You know, you add a whole dimension to it, what it means to be wealthy.
Of course, every society defines wealth in a different way. Let's say that in the European Western tradition, we tend to think that wealth is basically material wealth. So, you know, we tend to agree that with problems, of course, we can define it as aiming a high net worth, if you want. But then if we really look at the long run and if we look at different societies, we have, for example, the problem of understanding that if we look at the kind of consumption that rich people in the Roman Empire could have, that's very different from the kind of consumption that rich people today could have. There is a nice example made by Branko Milanović that says, okay, if we look at what Caesar could afford in Rome, to get something similar to what you can get, simply not to be able to read throughout the night and to listen to music for an entire day, he would have needed hundreds of servants or slaves to work for him.
Right.
So this also matters, because then the point is, are we all rich compared to Caesar or compared to Marcus Licinius Crassus, which was the richest Roman in this period, simply because we can, we can use a computer, or we can take a flight to the other corner of the world, and these people couldn't have. And of course, the answer is no, because every society has its own wealthy individuals and its own poor individuals. And so the point is that wealth has to be defined somehow based on the opportunities and also the technological characteristics of that society. And this is also why, what constitutes the main components of wealth change across time. You start out in the classical age, and then in the early modern period with real estate being the main item of wealth, land and buildings, basically. And then you move until today to a situation in which, as you know very well, financial assets have become a relatively more important component of wealth. They have always been there, but in terms of the relative composition of large patrimonies, they clearly are more important today than they were a few centuries ago. And that's also the tendency which is continuing now, no?
It's fascinating what you mentioned. And as you know, I work with wealthy individuals, families, and in many cases, multi-generational wealth. And I've worked over the years with families whose initial capital dates back, 100, 200 years. And then it's fascinating to see what it meant to remain wealthy over a long period of time, and how that wealth as such continued to reinvent itself in a way, from land to certain enterprises to other businesses and on and on. And it continues. Even the businesses we see today will not last forever. So it's capital wealth has its life of its own. But you touch on something fascinating, and I think Buffett brings it up, how John D. Rockefeller, who I think died in the 30s, in the 1930s or so, he had an elevator, I think, in his last home. But a lot of the things that we take for granted today, including having, music in your pocket and a powerful communication and entertainment device in your hand, these are the things that would be completely unavailable to even the richest people 100, 150 years ago. So we can laugh, entertain ourselves, even look up that Rembrandt painting on our little phone and enjoy it without ever traveling to London. I think that's where it is. To go see it in person, something that would be completely unheard of and impossible to even Andrew Carnegie, unless he rents a steamship and goes to Europe to see it. So it's fascinating to see it from that perspective. You mentioned a story in your book, which is a Kula ritual, if I pronounce it correctly, and it happens in the islands of Melanesia. Can you talk about it?
Yes.
It made me think of inheritance and stewardship. Can you tell the story?
Right. Yeah, of course. So this is one example I make in order to point out at how difficult it is to define what is wealth and who is to be considered rich, right? And again, there is, of course, this is something which is shaped by culture. Then in my book, I focus on Western culture precisely because I argue there is something which is specific to a given tradition and that allows me to look deeper. But this is really meant to showcase a very different context. So the Kula is a ritualistic exchange system in the Trobriand Islands in Melanesia, which is basically a ring of islands. Mm-hmm. And it's a system of exchange of items made out with seashells. So you have necklaces made with rat shells, which move clockwise along this ring of islands. And on the other direction, so counterclockwise, you have white shell armbands. Uh-huh. And the point is, the intrinsic value of this item, so the actual, you know, cost you have to incur in getting the shells is limited. But the point is, these items have their own story, right? So they carry prestige to those who hold them. But those who have them in a given moment can't keep them because the purpose is to exchange them. So, you know, they have to exchange them and they will get new ones continuously. So the point is, are these items valuable? As the intrinsic value is very low. And the problem is, you know, they are exchanged according to an assessment of their level, if you want. So they are evaluated, right? Because you have to exchange equal with equal in this context. And there is maybe an item which is worth more than others, right? And so one possible answer to the question, do they have a value, is simply, you know, they have because they are evaluated. But then there is also something more. They bring prestige to those who carry them. And the point is, this ritualistic exchange doesn't happen in a way which is entirely independent from more traditional economic exchange. Because the same canyons which carry, you know, the people having these items will also transport the goods they want to trade. So, you know, you get with your cooler items and they show you who you are, what's your prestige, and that maybe gives you an edge when you want to exchange non-ritual goods, right? So, you know, that's very fascinating, very complicated, but it you know, raises a number of questions. For example, what's the connection between having prestige, social prestige, and having economic opportunities? There is also another little problem. It's not like the population of the Trobriand has equal access to these items. They are very concentrated in few hands. Right. Mm-hmm. So again, what's the connection between concentration of prestige and maybe political power and economic opportunities? And the point is, this is a kind of a general question, but to answer that, you have to take into account the kind of society you're working with, right? So we could ask the same question for today or for the 19th century again in the West. And the question would be the same. Of course, the answer would be different because we're not exchanging necklaces, but maybe, you know, stock in stock markets. So.
Isn't it fascinating that societies around the world organized some sort of form of economic exchange and store of value and store of, you know, symbolic value as well? And you replace the shells with a dollar bill or a euro bill or with, you know, gold bars or gold coins. And even stock certificates that are virtual these days, they're not paper. But all those things have perceived value. And, you know, as investors, we're trying to figure out how much they're really worth and what they can produce to us. But it's a very complex system of trust and belief that allows us to function. And yes, somehow over time and throughout history, some people get to accumulate more of those tokens than the other ones. And that has some impact on them and the society they live in that you describe in your book. I want to ask you about the idea of getting rich, and I want to be playful about it. There are so many books about getting rich, and they're kind of about today and now, all kinds of ideas. But then you can look at history, and in your book, you show the actual paths that people took to riches, all the way from the conquest of the UK, today's UK, and people you know, conquering new lands and getting land, all the way to more entrepreneurial and trade-driven wealth. But the one thing that I saw in common across all those ages is what we call today entrepreneurship. Basically, that's what it is. You go out and you kind of create or take something from somewhere and build on it. Can you talk about those paths to riches throughout history? What are some of the most common ones? Maybe some ideas for the future as
well. Yes, absolutely. Well, in the book, I disentangle and focus three main paths to riches, which are, I mean, of course, you know, I do this having in mind the long run. So I focus on the path of nobility, which also allows me to focus on the issue of inheritance, because, you know, beyond the first generation, like, you know, the guys you mentioned, who the Normans who conquer England. So it's kind of first generation rich, but then their titles and their lands are passed on through inheritance. Then I focus on entrepreneurship. And then I disentangle finance from entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. which, of course, in practice, in many settings, is difficult to do. But it's important to do because there is a different perception of fortunes made in finance. So from the point of view of Western culture, it's important to, you know, to distinguish it as a path to wealth. So if we think in particular at entrepreneurship, this is, you know, first of all these three paths to some degree are present across history, but the actual importance of one or the other depends on the specific period you look at. So if we look at entrepreneurship, something which is, I think, very interesting is that it's possible to find in the history of the West phases when it has been relatively easy to build new wealth, right? Mm-hmm. With one's skills, abilities, one bold attempt at exploit new opportunities. And, you know, identify some phases like the so-called commercial revolution of the 11th century, when you have the development of long-range trade across the Mediterranean and then across the Baltic and the North Sea. Then you have the opening of the Atlantic trade routes at the beginning of the 16th century. Then you have the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century mostly. And then you have at least the beginning of the computer and information age in which we live. And the point is, however, that these phases of efflorescence, if you want, of new opportunities, at a certain point also dry up, right?
Right.
Which is interesting because you have the waves, and then why do they dry up? And of course, you could provide some idiosyncratic explanation, like, you know, every phase has its own reasons to end, like, I don't know, the phase of innovation, which characterizes the second industrial revolution, maybe ends because of the world wars. But there is also something more, which I point out in the book, and that's the problem of how, you know, again, there is a difference between the first generations and the generations that follow. You have that new wealth always become, well, not always, because somebody loses it, right? Tends to become old wealth. And uh-huh. then you have the establishment of these wealth dynasties, which start to control entire sectors, the most innovating area, the most innovating sectors in the economy. And then the question becomes whether this process of new wealth becoming old wealth also potentially contributes to drying up the wealth, right. The well of innovation, right? And that is a question which I ask without having for now an exact answer, but it's also something which maybe is interesting to think about for today, because we might actually be observing this process in this period. And it's not possible, if you look at history, to give for granted that if in a certain phase it's relatively easy to become rich because entrepreneurship, you know, this will also be the case like 10 years from now or 20 years from now. These changes can be also relatively sudden. Hopefully they won't, because often, you know, they are more sudden when there is the kind of more catastrophic change. So mm-hmm. let's hope this is not the case, if you want. And then the other thing which is new today is that if you look at how important finance is as right. a path to wealth, it's arguably more important today than at any previous point in history. And that's, you know, interesting by itself, and of course also can raise some questions, and, you know, it can become an interesting topic of research on its own and of discussion.
I want to come back to that, to finance and money, but I see it as stages. When I was reading your book, and it's a theme that I've been thinking about over many years, I wrote a book, Money, Life, Family, where I studied stories of actual families and how they accomplished to keep money over generations and the other ones that did not succeed and what we can learn from it. Now, you talked about land. Land by definition is limited, especially the useful land, and over the history until we found things underground, whether it was, you know, salt, coal or oil or other resources, it was what you can grow, which was farming. And there was only that much farmable land available, right? It was kept within the family or conquered and stolen throughout time, and entire countries would come in and grab land for that reason. But over time, the wealth got decoupled in stages from land. And you talk about trade. You know, trade is the first decoupling. Venice takes up a little piece of land, but was able to trade with the whole world at the time and accumulate huge wealth. And I think that's a prime example. You talk about Florence in your book as well. And then at some point, finance and money became this side effect. Some people accumulated wealth and money became a commodity in itself, made available to others. And nowadays, the entrepreneurship that we think of today is you basically create something out of nothing, right? You could have been born with no land, no capital, but you have an idea. And it could be a website that helps people connect around the world. And there you go. It becomes these days, even a $1 trillion idea. So it became more open-ended how wealth can be created over time. And I'm sure we'll come back to it. But I want to ask you about inherited wealth. You talk about it as something that defines the position in the society. And you start the story with nobility. And you bring us to modern times. Can you talk about, and you touched on it before, how you have the first generation, second generation, third generation, inherited wealth and the impact on how those families interact with the society and how the society sees them?
Yes, the problem with inherited wealth is, first of all, from the point of view of how important what you inherit is in defining how wealthy you will be in your life, this is also something which is becoming more important. So there is this decline in the importance of inherited wealth over total wealth from the beginning of the 20th century, and then from the 1970s on, inherited wealth has tended to become again more important, and this process is continuing to this day. And the point is that our society tends to look differently at those rich individuals who have made their wealth and those who have inherited it. So the point is inherited wealth is considered somehow less legitimate than wealth you made with your efforts. And then, of course, it's, if you look at what the actual individuals do, it's impossible to... it's impossible to define everybody in the same way, because you also have individuals who are brilliant entrepreneurs and who happen to have inherited a substantial amount of wealth, right? But there are also some more substantial concerns which have to do with what I was referring to earlier when I said that there is this question which I can at least be asked about whether, when you have the establishment of wealth dynasties, which actually are able to control large sectors of the economy, and this is, for example, the outcome of the Gilded Age, right? You have in the United States, after the first generations, you have these dynasties which become extremely wealthy, and then you get to the beginning of the 20th century, when there was a lot of concern about the supposed money trust which controlled the finance and the economy of the United States. And this also became a political issue, because both the left and the right of the time, both the political left and the political right of the time, were worried about how people like J.P. Morgan, if they wanted to, could have actually started to also control the politics of the country, right? So, there is this... there is this problem. But the point is whether this concentration of wealth in some dynasties of wealth can actually prevent part, at least, of the economic opportunities that otherwise you would have had, based on the context and based on the technology of the period and so forth and so on. And if you want to look at this with another modern perspective, the issue is also that of social mobility, because the more important inherited wealth is over total wealth, the more difficult it is to believe that actually if you start out in your life from a relatively low position, you will be able to move up. And we have culturally a preference for mobile societies. This comes very clear from the surveys which sociologists ask to people. You know, everybody in general would agree, I think, that a society which is more mobile, in which, you know, individuals who have good skills, good attitudes, who also are maybe a little bit lucky, but also in the sense of having taken a risk and, you know, being able to exploit it. You know, we want them to be able to rise in terms of their economic standing. But that's more difficult to happen structurally if inheritances are more important to define the wealth pyramid, you know, which you have at the beginning of this process. So from this point of view, there is a societal problem when inheritances become too important. Then obviously the point is that from the individual point of view, we all want to give our children, our descendants, the best possible opportunities. So this is also very, very, very clear across history, right? So it's very human. I think it's a very human ambition that to be able to pass on something to one's descendant. Problem is, in this case, you have maybe a private virtue which can become a public sin in the sense that, again, it can run contrary if this becomes a collective behavior, contrary some sort of more general interest of the society. It's a very complicated topic to address, of course, and there is, I think, no obvious solution to the problem.
I like this idea of never starting from scratch again. So the lessons that I've learned working with families and the books that I wrote, you know, to me, it's less about turning billions into trillions, but thinking, what is it that we can learn from this shared experience so that more of us don't have to start from zero with the next generation? I grew up in Poland. Poland had world wars, communism. If your wealth wasn't confiscated, burned down, damaged, then one way or the other was lost. So I've heard stories, even within my family, of, you know, wealth created, but it was almost impossible to maintain it throughout centuries or generations. So to me, it's very interesting to think of, you know, I talk about this idea that we don't burn all the books with every generation. We tap into the knowledge that's been accumulated. And with capital and wealth at the big societal level and also individual family level, you would love to have something for the next generation to start with. And I don't even want to, you know, start the topic about the fact that some people, especially in the US, start with a negative net worth when they graduate from school, given the student debt. But to have something to start with, I think it allows for options, choices, freedom in terms of how you're going to start your life. So it doesn't have to be $1 billion, but something that can get you started on the path. So that's how I look at it. The second thing immediately I was thinking about when you brought up inherited wealth. So the wealth was created usually in one business and so on, and eventually becomes a collection of businesses and a portfolio of investments. But the families that inherited wealth need a new wave of wealth being created with the next generation, not always themselves within the family, but they need part of society to be very entrepreneurial. So they have opportunities with their inherited capital to put that capital to work into new businesses, new industries, new ideas. And usually those are created by people that very likely started with nothing. So in a peculiar way, you were talking about the pearl and the oyster. But for the system to continue and the wealth even to continue to the next generation, the railroad fortunes would not have survived, and many of them haven't, unless they were put in into other industries and on and on and on. Even Berkshire Hathaway, that a lot of people know, you know, the textile industry that it was in initially when Buffett took it over, the business became, got invested in other industries all the way to, you know, technology today. So you kind of need the two sides, you know, inherited wealth that provides capital, and then the new ideas and the fresh wave of entrepreneurship that allows that capital to perpetuate. I think it's a peculiar coexistence of the two. I don't know if you have thoughts, but that's what I was thinking about reading your book.
No, I kind of agree. You need capital, and that's the issue, that's the problem of the original concentration of capital. So you have to need some reserves of capital which are concentrated in the, you know, then the hands, for example, of wealthy individuals to be ready to be invested in the new opportunities. That's something which is clear. The problem is also, however, that if you look at this historically, capital has always been relatively abundant. As you were saying before, land was the problem in a pre-industrial society. And there is a reason why the classical economists were distinguishing three factors of production. So labor, capital, and land, not two as the neoclassical economists do to this day, right? And they argued that what was really scarce was land, because, you know, the amount of land can't be expanded infinitely. There is a geographic constraint. So the point is, some concentration of capital, some accumulation of capital is needed to have economic development, and I would agree with that. But beyond a certain limit, it's no longer needed. And arguably, again, if you accept, at least as a hypothesis, my argument about how an excessive rigidity of, you know, the control of the economy in the hands of wealth dynasties, about how these could stifle innovation. Well, you know, you can get to a situation in which it is too much, because it prevents innovation coming from people who do not begin with any substantial amount of capital. So to me, it's more a matter of balancing and of finding a way of balancing these across the generations. Let me tell you something more about inheritances, and it is this. I entirely agree that the point is we want our children to start out with something, and there is also a general interest in having the new generation starting out with something. Now, let me make you this example, right? So think about societies in, say, the 15th century or 16th century or 17th century, when after the Black Death of 1347, 52, they knew that it was possible that a new plague came and killed, like, you know, half the people in the city they lived. So the point is, these people knew very well that they couldn't do anything to ensure that their descendants would have survived, right? So what they could ensure was the survival of their patrimony. And there is this juridical saying, familia idest substantia in Latin, which means the family is the patrimony. So that's why they were actually trying to protect the patrimony across the generations. And basically they did this by making it impossible, you know, for it to become fragmented because of inheritances, even impossible to sell it because they weren't trusting their descendants to be, you know, oculated with how they were using their money. So they were kind of protecting the patrimonies because they wanted to protect the family, and they couldn't protect the individual members of the family because it was, So, you know, I think it's a very human feeling, this one. One wants to endow the descendants with something, right? Because we want to ensure that they will have the best opportunities in life. The problem, again, is only when from these individual attitudes, a collective problem arises, and that's when there might be space for some sort of, you know, regulation of society, right? But from the point of view of individual aspirations, I think it's very human, if you want. And in some contexts, it's also very rational, right? All those who made the experience of, you know, losing everything want to avoid that from happening again. And the experience of Europe in the first half of the 20th century surely shaped generations of people from that point of view.
Very much so. You know, reading your book and thinking of the research studies I've done over the years, I think of wealthy families in general as an exception to the rule. The fact that the wealth lasts multiple generations, it's more of an exception. And I'm always curious to study what happened. How was it possible? And I brought up, you know, Poland, big parts of the world that have had a hard time preserving wealth. Poland had a beautiful run the last three decades and post-communism. And I think it changed more than at any other period in time. And I'm very impressed. But then I think of, you said, the Gilded Age. U.S. at the time, it was after the Civil War, no conflict on its own territory, no experiments with communism, No invasions of any kind, and no big plans of confiscation of wealth from the government. Obviously, taxation went up and down throughout time. But still, those families that you mentioned, the Gilded Age families, they're not among the richest today. And obviously, there was innovation and change and all that. I get it. But I think you would agree that a lot of the trouble came from within, which is, you know, overspending and poor investment choices and inflated lifestyle. I think you write something in the book how sometimes the rich lifestyle is too expensive even for the rich. And I think that's you know, a real challenge that people spend money. So it's fascinating that nature, I think the big point is that nature, if you could look at it that way, has a way of bringing things back to the average. So the exceptional wealth that was created, somehow it gets reabsorbed one way or the other. And it's very hard to maintain it over longer than a few generations. You bring up the shirt sleeve to shirt sleeve in three generations proverb in your book, which is translated into all the languages in the world, apparently. And it's a shared phenomenon for everybody out there. Like keeping wealth, even if it's a good context, good country, good political system, keeping that wealth over more than a few generations is a challenge. So I don't know if you have thoughts about it, but it seems like it's a matter of time when even the biggest wealth gets somehow reabsorbed.
Although, in the 20th century, a very important role was also played. I mean, especially if you think about the American context and some other Western countries, but the beginning of the 20th century is also when there is a direct attempt by governments to break down certain concentration of influence over the economy. That's, you know, all the antitrust legislation in the United States goes into this direction. And then there is also a phase during which wealth is made relatively uninheritable by means of historically very high taxation on estates and inheritances, right? Mm-hmm. So in that phase, you know, there are like 4 years during which that also played a big role. And on top of that, we have all the damage caused by the world wars and the interwar period in terms of, you know, destruction of financial capital because of hyperinflation or physical destruction of wealth in many areas of Europe and so forth and so on. But otherwise, of course, there is a tendency for some, at least some of these wealthy dynasties to kind of, you know, disappear. And that can happen for a number of reasons. They can become extinguished and, you know, you can have no descendants. And I could make, you know, examples of these. This happens very often, more often than we think, actually, than we are used to think. And then there is the problem of having some descendants who are spendthrift. And there is an interesting thing here, and I'd like to quote this. This is from the famous Italian poet Dante, maybe the greatest poet of Italy, who is in Divine Comedy, is punishing right together in hell the hoarders and the spenders, right? So it's like, you know, it's difficult to decide what's the worst seed, right?
Uh-huh.
But, you know, if you look at these dynasties, sometimes if you look how they refer to some of their members, it's quite clear that from the point of view of a wealthy dynasty, the worst sin is that of spending too much, not that of hoarding, of course, for the reasons which were discussed. Because, you know, if you hoard, you will, you know, automatically pass on something. If you spend too much, you will ruin your descendants, not only yourself. But there is another thing which I would like to highlight, which is one reason why I'm not entirely in agreement with the idea that this kind of, you know, natural process which you described is very relevant mm-hmm. when you think about current social concerns. And the point is, the problem is the matter of scale. So are we talking about the last 1,000 right. years, the last 3 centuries, or the next 20 years, right? Because mm-hmm. that's not the kind of dynamic which will matter much for, you know, for us in our lives, right? It might matter mm-hmm. To, you know, forecast the situation of our grandchildren, but this is not right. a process which we will really observe because it's too slow. So it's not like it mm-hmm. doesn't matter, but it matters more for understanding history than for right. answering questions and concerns about today. That's the point I would make. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we are interested in the immediate, in the short run, in the medium run, but we are, you know, we only with difficulty we could discount what will happen maybe in the next 100 years, right?
It's a good point, because we humans live in terms of, you know, a few decades. And when you think of history, we zoom out so far away. So you and I can say, well, there was Gilded Age, came to an end, we moved on, railroads went bankrupt, and you know, governments took them over. And the wealth that was in the railroads, in many cases, is gone, not at least not in the sense that it was back then. But when you're living in the Gilded Age, or you're living today, and you're thinking about my attention span is even 2 decades, 20 years, you might be at the beginning of Gilded Age, and 2 decades later, it's still the same Gilded Age, right? So I think that's your point, that once you zoom in as an individual, you see that the change is a lot slower than a history book would imply. There's one big theme, you know, you brought up taxation. But you have a quote from Andrew Carnegie. He said something along the lines that once you get rich, your next goal is to give it all away. And can you talk about that? So obviously governments can come in and tax away the income and the wealth and the assets. But then there's this theme that even comes back in today's world of, you know, giving pledge of, yes, I've been fortunate in this lifetime, but I will give most of it away. And Warren Buffett is one of the people that chose to do that. Can you talk about that?
Yes, Carnegie very famously said, he who dies rich dies disgraced. And he set out to donate his vast wealth, most of his vast wealth before his death. Mm-hmm. Now, Carnegie actually was, he was doing this in a new way, if you want, but in a long-running tradition. And at the beginning of this, you have the medieval worry about the afterlife, right? Because the point is, in the Middle Ages, rich people were considered sinners, and their sin was greed. Because, you know, if they were, this wasn't an issue for the nobles, because the nobility had their superior access to economic resources because of how God had ordained society, if you want. But the commoners who became rich, those people were the problem. And the point is, if they became rich, why was that? You know, what was their wealth for? If they could have instead used it to help the poor or to do some charitable activity and so forth and so on. And this suspicion that by having grown rich, they were actually committing a serious sin of the kind that, you know, according to Dante Alighieri, would have, you know, condemned you to hell, led many among the medieval rich and the early modern rich to donate a lot before their death or through their wills, right? And by the way, we have examples of institutions endowed, say in the 14th century, which continue to exist today, and to perform charity in ways similar to those intended by their original founders, and that's of course something amazing. But the point is, there was this worry that having accumulated something very substantial, you had somehow committed a sin, and then in order to ensure your spiritual salvation, you had to amend, to make amend, and that means basically making charity in the final parts of one life. So this is different today, of course. This is not how Carnegie was looking at this. This is not how the people who subscribed the giving pledge look at this, but it's still the same kind of cultural tradition. Like, you rise to great wealth, to super wealth, but then you give back most, or at least a very substantial part of the wealth through, you know, the endowment of institutions or the funding of causes which are relevant for society, right? Of benefit to society in general. And this is interesting. This is something which, of course, can produce a real public benefit. I think that the actual problem here is only that and this is a point I make in the book also, this can't be seen as a substitute for taxation. This is something different, right? It's not like you can argue for, you know, lower taxation on the super rich because then the super rich will make more charity. It's not the same thing, right? That leads to a number of possible issues regarding how society is organized. But if we get rid of that, I think it's a potentially very positive behavior on the part of the super rich. We have to be careful about one thing, however, it's not necessarily something that we have to always understand as generosity or philanthropy, pure and simple, because there is also maybe something you can get in exchange if you endow institutions, you know, and that's again the issue of prestige and influence, including political influence or even just, you know, cultural influence you get in exchange. Again, this is not necessarily something bad per se, but it's something that we have to be aware of. And in the past, it was much clearer to our, you know, it was much clearer to our ancestors that people like, I don't know, Cosimo de' Medici, say in 15th century Florence, when he was, this guy established the first public library in Europe, the Medici Library, right? So it's, you know, and he endowed many charitable institutions, monasteries, and so forth and so on. But it was clear to everybody that he was doing this because he was making kind of a claim to have a right to lead politically city in this way. Right. So this was called magnificence in that moment. But magnificence means doing great deeds, you know, for the collectivity. But it's not munificence, so which means doing gifts. So magnificence is not generosity. That's the problem. We tend to use words like, you know, giving, philanthropy. And there might be something which we hide behind these words. At least in some cases, there is a serious concern about this. So this is something we have to be aware of. And this is also something that we need to take into account when we look at, you know, again, at the mix of taxation versus accumulation and then giving that we want to have in society. I think that the real issue is to try and strike the good balance between all these different features, I would say.
I lived half of my life in Europe and half of my life in the US, and I can tell that both continents have a different take on both what charity, philanthropy means, and government taxation. And I think the role of giving and the role of the government that steps in and also gives, you know, evens out what the perceived right balance is. So I think there are many ways to go about it. And it's fascinating to see how that has evolved over time and what we can learn from it and what we can practice in the future. But yeah, it's a wonderful conversation. I want to ask you about the role of women. And I wrote an article years ago about the role of women in keeping and growing family wealth. And I really smiled and when I saw in your book how you bring up the topic of women, how throughout history, women held the majority of financial assets at times. And you also touch on the stock market, how the appearance of a joint stock company and shareholder counted in thousands instead of very private small operations open up the business to and opportunities to women. Can you talk about the two topics, the fact that women played such a big role and this joint stock market world open up the world to women and more people in general, not just the, let's say, the cliquey elite group that had the capital initially?
So, yes, this is actually fascinating. And this is one of the features of the role played by finance in history, which is often forgotten. The problem, of course, is the fact that is, you know, it's first and foremost in the fact that women were not recognized juridically the same ability to act in the economy as men. So, you know, this is born out of gender-based discrimination, of course. And the problem is, compared to other sectors of the economy, the women were much freer to act in finance than, you know, in trade, right? And in many cases, these women were widows with underage children who were basically inheriting the asset of the family or were managing the asset of the family in the interest of their children. Often they needed to have intermediaries like the notaries in the early modern period to act, but still they quite clearly, when we can observe how they act, they were perfectly able to operate in an accurate way and to get very good profits. And, you know, in many settings, their share of invested capital is in between 20-30%. So still, you know, less than what men put into the business, but very, very substantial. And when the modern stock markets developed, they had only an extra opportunity. This is also, of course, the moment when they start, you know, acquiring greater juridical capacity to act on their own. That's a progressive development. But in Wall Street, there was a group of female investors which were clearly playing a substantial role. They were among the most important investors in the railroad business, in the shares of the railroad business, and so forth and so on. And the problem, however, historically is also that given that they were able to inherit financial capital, they also could become prey. And if I can, I will tell you a little story about a very striking woman, a Portuguese woman from the 16th century,
yes.
Gracia Nasi, also you know, also called Beatriz de Luna or, you know, Gracia Mendes. She has different names because of her story. So she was born at the beginning of the 16th century. She belonged to a family of Marranos. So these were Jews converted to Christianity. And she was made to marry her uncle, Francisco Mendes, when she was pretty young. And Francisco Mendes belonged to a family which had been one of the main investors in the efforts to open the trade from Portugal to India, circumnavigating Africa. And this is why, by the beginning of the 16th century, this family had a very important share of the import of pepper in Europe. Problem is, Francisco dies, so Gracia Nasi becomes a widow. And the problem is, she becomes an extremely wealthy widow. And the problem is then that she's a potential prey, if you want. On top of that, she belonged to a family of converted Jews, which also placed her at risk of persecution. In 1536, there is the establishment of the Portuguese Inquisition in Portugal, and then she flees, basically, in 1538, when she becomes a widow, and she goes to Antwerp in the Low Countries, where she joins the husband of her deceased husband, Jogo. And she clearly co-manages the family fortune with Jogo to the point that in his will, Jogo establishes that upon his death, Gracia Nasi has to become the manager of the entire fortune of the Mendes family. Then unfortunately, Jogo dies and Gracia Nasi has again the problem of being an even richer widow alone in the Low Countries. And that's when, you know, the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, the great emperor of the 16th century, decides that he could actually try and make her marry a junior member of the House of Aragon, who had promised to pay him a very nice gift in case this matchmaking proves successful. And she really doesn't want to do this, so she has to flee with some subterfuge. She goes to Aachen, saying that she's going to the thermal baths, and from there she flees. She goes with her daughter. She goes to Lyon, then she goes to Venice, and she ends up in Ferrara, in Italy, which was a very open place at that moment in time, the 16th century. It also had one of the largest Jewish communities in Italy, and from there she continues to manage the activities of her family, but she also resumes open practice of the Jewish religion. So she, in fact, hadn't truly converted to Christianity And that became a problem even in Ferrara, because she became charged with apostasy, which means having abandoned the Christian religion, and that wasn't acceptable. So she flees in 1553 to Constantinople, where she starts to cooperate with the Sultan there. And Constantinople in that moment was the most open of all European cities in the end. And she also uses the connections and the money of her family to help persecuted Jewish people escape persecution from across Europe. She could actually use her resources to act across the continent. And this is a very striking example, because first it demonstrates, it's a perfect case of an extremely capable woman who were mastering all the skills needed to operate in high finance in the early modern time. But this is also a perfect example of the kind of dangers that a rich woman who wasn't, covered or protected by a husband or by a father experienced in a context in which, of course, there was nothing like parity in treatment between the sexes. That's obvious. But this is, again, an early example of how women played a very important role in this area. Often, the problem we have is that the economic activities of women tend to be hidden by the sources. They do not appear because we can see, we get information about what their husband usually does. Although mm-hmm. we know in many settings that they were actually helping very directly with the management of these early, if you want, multinational companies which existed in finance, but even more importantly in trade from the late Middle Ages on.
It's fascinating. And as you pointed out, even given my research, it's that you have to really look to realize, oh, it was women that allowed for certain survival and continuity of some business operations throughout history, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, all the way to today. And nowadays we talk about it more, but in history books, you really have to make an effort to see who was really in charge. And there are documents, and the Rothschild family actually put it in some documents, how it was the mother that was supposed to be making decisions when the father was no longer around, and their families in the steel industry in France and Alsacia in Germany and thus. So it's fascinating how those stories repeat, and it's wonderful that you were able to bring it up to the surface and tell those stories of this particular family and a woman that was juggling so many different obstacles and challenges while tapping into the opportunities that the world was creating at the time with the international trade and finance. I want to ask you about making money with money, and you bring it up in the book a couple of times. So when you look around, land means something different today, and even entrepreneurial opportunities mean something different today. But the idea of, you call it being the shrewd management of money, has always offered great opportunities for personal enrichment. That really stayed the same for a couple of millennia now, one way or the other. Can you talk about that? Isn't it fascinating how that hasn't really changed? Obviously, we use laptops and software, but not bags of gold coins these days. But the ideas, the principles are very much the same.
Yes, I really agree. And the problem is that to a substantial degree, this is because one basic necessity is always the same. If you don't have enough money, to operate your activity or to, start a new entrepreneurial activity, you will have to borrow it. And, lending and borrowing in different forms, but have existed with this, very strong continuity from classical antiquity to this day. They were, lending for an interest was really frowned upon in the Middle Ages, because the idea was that all lending for an interest was potentially usury. But not even this condemnation from the Christian religion could, stop it from happening, because people needed it.
Right.
And there were mm-hmm. two categories of people who needed it, which are still those who need it today. First, the entrepreneurs. So, to fund international trade, you need to have the availability of substantial financial resources at different corners of the Mediterranean or of Europe. That's how it starts out. And then you will need to have people who are able to provide you credit in different parts of the continent, because you don't want to have to move with sacks of gold coins on your, you know, on your body, because you know, that will make you a very interesting prey for pirates and whatever pirates and what you want. And the other category of serial borrowers were, of course, public governments. And right. the main issue historically has been to fund war and defense. So when you have a war, mm-hmm. you have to wage the war, and you have to, you need to secure access to financial resources at almost at any cost and however you can. And then you will need people who are able to give you that money, which is why medieval theologians never won their war against lending for an interest, because the governments to begin with needed that kind of service. And so yes, we have of course a change in the kind of sectors in which entrepreneurship is most active. We have a change in how international trade happens. Now we have global trade, but the kind of financial services which you need in the end are very, very similar, right? The problem is mm-hmm. really the same in history. And so you have this specialized group of people who has always been there. The difference today, I think that the main difference today is how sizable that group of people is. Today you have many more people who are active in finance, as I said, than at any previous moment in history. Even if you take the main financial hubs of the 19th century, like London or New York, they will not be comparable to even the average across the West today, right, in some mm-hmm. respects. I look, for example, at the share of rich people in 19th century America or the UK who made their wealth in finance, and I compare that to the billionaires in the West today based on Forbes database, and you have that the average across the West is higher than the average in the main financial hubs one century ago. So it's a clear trend.
It's fascinating how much has changed around us, the industries and the services and everything. But the idea that some people have the capital and some people need the capital, whether it's the government, businesses, or consumers, that seems to remain the same. And obviously how it's conducted changes. And as you said, no sacks of bags of gold coins and so on. Maybe now it's apps and other solutions. But at the end of the day, the principles, the need, the service, it's exactly the same. This conversation wouldn't be complete if I didn't ask you about the why. And it comes up in your book. We're talking about very wealthy individuals that accomplished something in their lifetime at different points in time. And you embark on, an attempt to answer the question, why did they even get rich? Why do we even care to get rich? Can you talk about that? I found it really intriguing because I think it's relevant today with money being on a lot of people's minds.
Of course, at the individual level, especially if you start from a middling or a lower social economic group, there is the aspiration of improving one's position in life, which has to do both with getting access to a kind of consumption that it's possible, but you can't achieve without being wealthy. But also, it's kind of a urge to try and rise in this kind of wealth pyramid. And connected to this, there is the aspiration to pass something on to the descendants, which is what we have which we have already discussed. But then, when you get at the very highest levels, there is also something different, which is what I call the race. So the point is, it becomes like a competition to some degree. And there are also some billionaires who see this explicitly in this way. There is, for example, the case of Haroldson Hunt, who was an oil tycoon in the US of the early 20th century, and he said money in the end is just a way of keeping scores, and it's the game that matters, like, because after a certain level of wealth, you can't even expand more your consumption, because unless you really want to do you know, what Bezos did and, you know, go in orbit, but it's like you can already buy everything you might really desire. So there is a mix of things which is different if you look at, you know, the super rich or the ultra rich or the very rich or simply the rich. What I think is also interesting is that this urge to pass something on to the ascendancy is something that is very clear if you look at history, but it's not clear at all if you take into account economic theory, which I think is a bit faulty regarding this topic, right? You know, the idea is, you know, it's Modigliani and Friedman, is that in the end, if you
incomplete.
Save during
I
your...
I would say it's...
Yeah, I mean, it's... So...
So it's fascinating, you know, as an investor, and I buy stakes in companies when I buy shares of companies. And there's this idea that you want somebody to be running this business that sees this as almost a higher calling. You know, I had a conversation with somebody here on the podcast, how they have this pride in the work that they do and they have the soul in the game, and they show up every day to make this big business better and bigger. Way past the point of any financial incentive. They are worth the kind of money that is even hard to imagine, impossible to spend. I'm sure there are ways to waste it away, but that's not what drives them. They show up again and again, and sometimes work really long hours because they're on a mission. And that's something that we call people like that fanatical founders, in a way that they keep on going. And obviously you can have CEOs that get hired and have the same kind of relationship with the business. But by definition, if they're doing something bigger and better, their wealth will continue to grow. But the focus has moved away from the financial needs, the shelter and the food and the opportunities for the kids and all that. So it's fascinating to see how that exceptional wealth gets created when the focus actually moves away from the money. And it's about providing a better service or product to more people at hopefully a lower cost around the world. That's really the formula for the biggest wealth creation that we've seen in the last generation or two. And yeah, it's fascinating that the why is not really about the money at the end of the day. Before I let you go, I want to ask you about some of the dangers that could lie ahead. You've seen in your research so many stories where the wealth, yes, was created, but then it was lost. Can you talk about some of the most common paths to losing substantial wealth throughout history? They seem to rhyme as well.
I think that there are two main ways to lose the wealth, the individual wealth and the family wealth. The first is to squander wealth, right? That's famous, you know, the spenders, again, punished in hell by Dante Alighieri and so forth and so on. And then there is a catastrophe, and a catastrophe of the kind which can actually destroy wealth is usually war. And this is an interesting thing because during wars we have that there are new opportunities to become very wealthy, right? So you could even argue that during wars, the rich are the apex predators, right? Because they are well positioned to exploit the opportunities of war, even simply because they have the capital to provide governments to fund the world effort. But at the same time, they become historically the main preys because their wealth can't be easily hidden. And this is clear, say, in Europe during the World Wars. It's very clear in the case of Jewish persecution at the hands of the Nazi during World War II. They were actually despoiled in a very bureaucratic way, which is also why we know about this, and to some degree it was possible to revert this process, right? It was possible to give back to the families of those who survived, of course, what was left of their original patrimony, and we see this in in early modern times. We see this in the case of cities when they were besieged and then conquered. They were subject to the sack. And during a sack, systematically you have that the rich have, you know, to save their lives, but basically paying large ransoms, right? And the point is, this is something that in certain contexts can really bring to ruin. So this kind of catastrophe, war-induced. And then sometimes you have cases of financial catastrophe, which can also destroy the fortunes of entire families, which can be triggered, you know, by different things. And in that case, maybe the kind of investments done by these families were not the most accurate or the most perfectly differentiated. And that is what exposed them to more risks. But in the end, I would say the way in which you can really see dramatic failures in protecting individual and family wealth have to do either with excessive spending, but on a really excessive scale, if you want, or right. certain kinds of large-scale catastrophes.
I like this idea that the rich lifestyle can be too expensive even for the rich sometimes, and I think that's what happened to some of the railroad fortunes, the Vanderbilts building bigger and bigger palaces that they could not possibly maintain. And the second part of what you say, it can be taken away. So yes, the wealthy are at the top in many ways, but they're also the easiest target, especially if the wealth is connected to the location. And if there's a shift in the government or a conflict, then it can be very quickly taken away. And it's pretty easy usually to tell who has it, right? So it's happened throughout history that wealth was confiscated again and again. And in my book, Money, Life, Family, I mentioned the two Cuban families that both had a rum business. One family had only operations in Cuba. The other one had some international presence and trademarks outside of Cuba. And one is the Bacardi family. And they were able to continue their business past what happened to Cuba, which was the government was taken over and businesses were confiscated and so on. So it makes you think of the choice of the location, which I actually highlight in my writing, how it can be very important if you get to keep what you have. Over 20 years, it may not matter, but over 100 years, location starts to matter a lot. Thank you so much for today. It was such a wonderful conversation. I could keep you for another 5 hours because I I took so many notes and questions from your book, but I think we touched on the big, big themes, and I highly recommend your book. It's such a wonderful read, and you have this gift for, you know, taking the reader on this journey, like a time traveler, back and forth between different points in time, and realizing how this is all a human experience, and it happens again and again and again. The names, the context, the places change, but this will continue to happen. And I think history books are a remarkable guide to the future. Like, if you're curious what will happen, other people will get rich, some other people will try to take it, and there will be ups and downs throughout history, and they will play all kinds of roles in societies, hopefully more positive than not. But that's what I took away from your book. A wonderful read. And thank you again so much for today. What a pleasure.
Thank you. I loved having this conversation. So thank you again for inviting me to have this.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes, and so are the opinions of the host and employee and partner of a registered investment advisor and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on the firm is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available on advisorinfo.sec.gov.
Thank you.